Arzak Frastica for Cameron. Although your fingers and my eyes agree, it is unheard of, Cameron, what you see. Describing scenes of color, form, and light, which you perceive by any means but sight. We cannot know the god's unheard of head, protested Rilka, when he should have said, unseen, because we hear of it from him, in carnal terms, becoming of a hymn to any of those bad old gods, the kind that loved man's form, but not his living mind, delighting in some tyrant's blinding wrath, then disappearing in the aftermath.
Well, hello everybody, this is Tim Green with Rattle Magazine. Welcome to Rattlecast number 226. Thanks so much for joining me. Today's guest, Matthew Buckley Smith, is here. Before we begin, I should say that Rattle is a publication of the Rattle Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit working to promote the practice of poetry. We've been in continuous publication since 1995 and are unaffiliated with any other organization. We just do this because we love poetry, and I know you do too, so please do click the like button and share. Make sure you're subscribed, ring the bell for notifications. And I think you can do to help spread poetry around the internet. It is much appreciated. And Happy New Year to all you out there on our New Year's Day show. The festivities are mostly over, so we thought it'd be fun to have a show anyway, despite the holiday. Today's guest is Matthew Buckley Smith. Matthew makes a podcast and writes stuff. That's the bio on his website. And I can really relate, actually, to just wanting to say something as simple like that. But if you say more, his poems of stories appeared in Agni, American Life and Poetry, and elsewhere. His first book of poems, Dirge for an Imaginary World, was selected by Andrew Hudgens for the 2011 Able Muse Book Award. His second book of poems, Midlife, was selected by David Yetzi for the 2021 Richard Wilbur Award, and we published soon. So we have a sort of an advanced copy. I have a link to the pre-sale, which we'll put in the show notes, and you can pick it up ahead of time. But that is Midlife. And so two great books out, a wonderful formal poet. And here he is, Matthew Buckley Smith. Hey, Matthew, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. I think there may be some tantrum was happening downstairs, but I have a reprieve from it. So yeah, I'm doing okay right now.
Well, that's great. And there's been interested in formal verse. That's the thing that when I see a poem of yours, I think, oh, great, this is going to be formal, because there's a there's so little of it around that's done really well, or even attempts at it these days. And you write so beautifully in the form. Is that something that you were always drawn toward, was using meter and rhyme?
No, I mean, I liked formal. I mean, what we call formal poetry today for a very long time was just poetry. So I like plenty of that stuff, and I always have. I wrote in, you know, doggerel, that is to say, meterless rhyme for a long time as a kid, and then I got sophisticated, and I learned that sophisticated poems aren't written in form, and so I wrote a lot of reverse, and I wrote a lot of poetry that had cool words in it but didn't make sense and didn't have complete sentences, and some of that, you know, I think I learned some things. The school where I went to college and took a bunch of classes, they were very much invested in poetry that was interested most of all in being unpredictable, and so they weren't language poets, but they were descended from the language poets. They were like the children of the Titans or something, you know. And it wasn't really until meeting Ryan my junior year and kind of getting a little bit reoriented by him toward poems that made sense. And then going to grad school, which was really just me following Ryan to Baltimore, that I had some great teachers, including Mary Jo, Greg Williamson, who's a terrific, underappreciated formal poet, really taught me form more than anybody. John Irwin, a bunch of people. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of kicking and screaming, was dragged into form, and then just couldn't escape. Like, I think like a lot of people who started writing in form later on, once I started, I couldn't. I occasionally tried to write in free verse, and it is not good. The results are embarrassing.
Did you have like formal training? Was it like classes in meter? Is that something you did, or was it more just reading and being introduced to different poets and hearing it and then taking it through that channel?
Oh, both. I mean, a lot of both. I did. I should say, like, I had a really good teacher in high school who taught, who like gave me the basics of meter, that and that was really helpful. And then I had my weird mentor figure who introduced me to A. Stalling's work, and I remember reading that and thinking like, oh, I've been wasting my time. why don't my poems sound this good? Mostly I got a lot of instruction in graduate school that was very helpful. And that, I mean, Greg's classes, like Taylor Bias called Studying Under Adam Vine's, like going to formal boot camp. And that's very much what Greg was like.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to learn it whether you want to or not.
Yeah. Well, let's dive into your book that's forthcoming. Sure. Do you know what publication date? Is that known yet?
Amazon says January 8th.
Oh, okay. Well, that's really soon.
Yeah.
There you go.
Who knows?
Okay. Well, yeah, let's start out with one of that's the introductory kind of poem, The Year Of, from
yeah, Facebook. sort of a New Year poem, kind
yeah.
of.
Yeah, it is.
The Year Of. It was not beautiful. It did not rhyme. A brick came loose. A text message came late. We lacked the understanding, then the time, to put things straight. Results were lost. Releases went unsigned. Defective units had already sold. The smaller demographics fell behind. The trail went cold. A judge enforced the non-disclosure form. The damage wasn't covered by the plan. The girl got transferred to a different dorm. The threats began. Some children were too young to understand. A biopsy was needed to confirm. The prototype, regrettably, was manned. Budgets were short-term. Though we were brave, though we were dutiful, not all of us were fitted for the climb. It was not fair. It was not beautiful. It did not rhyme.
Yeah, and that's the opening poem to Midlife. That's The Year Of by Matthew Buckley Smith. And so this, in the leaf flyer side, it says that these are the poems that you've written since your last book. It's basically one of the things. Yeah. Any sort of a, I guess I'm learning a typical a sly manner. So what was the theme? How did the theme emerge from this book? Is it just did you have like these poems and then realize what you were writing about? How did the book come together with over time, given that they're, you know, you characterize them that way as the poems that you've written since your last book?
Yeah, I'm sort of being coy there, but I'm really fairly literal. I think I say the best poems because there are a whole lot of other poems that are not in the book that are very bad. But yeah, this is what I think are the best poems since my last book. This is where like you can definitely explain yourself out of mystery, or like you can definitely, I might like show you the shark robot and ruin the effect, but I don't really believe in book projects or themes. I kind of think like when I talk to poets who say I have two poetry manuscripts I'm sending around, I want to say like, maybe you just have one and you need to take the best half from each and, you know, send out the really good stuff. I just tend to think that I don't know, poetry books last so briefly. Like a poetry collection as a collection is ephemeral. I mean, how many poetry collections, even like from famous poets of the 20th century, do we really, really remember as collections? There's like not a lot. There's Ariel, Life Studies, Wits and Weddings, Geography 3, Boy's Will, or no, North of Boston, maybe. But like, honestly, what we really remember are individual poems. Because mm-hmm. like a lot of those books, you know, those are, you know, Larkin was pretty choosy, but like, as Bishop was as well. But like in many cases, it's just like a handful of poems that emerge. And like, those are the keepers, and the rest of them sort of like, well, that was okay to read. And now I've forgotten about it. And that's kind of how I think about my own books. I'm just trying to like, this is the best I've got from the last I think in the jacket flap it says 9 years, and then the press that was supposed to publish it went under, and so it's actually 12 years now.
So would you say, do you think we publish too many books? Is that like a problem within poetry? If you think they should be combined, do you think there are too many of them?
I think I definitely argue with people about this. And the person who yells at me the most about it is Matt Wall, who's also a very entertaining podcaster. You should check out. I hate Matt Wall. He makes a living off of his poems. He publishes a chapbook like once a month or so. And multiple books a year. And he pumps them out and he peddles them comic books. And that's how he pays his bills. If you do that, I don't think you're publishing too many books. Mm-hmm. Like, if that's how you're paying, like, go for it. There's sci-fi writers who like pump out like Kindle books and they have to write a lot of them to keep their audience. If that's what you're doing, go for it. But there are a lot of especially academic poets who have a kind of a comfortable relationship with the press, and they have an established relationship with they have an established reputation, and they have a kind of a circuit of schools where their friends teach, and they know they can go read there and their friends will come read here. And they just know that, like, oh, I guess I've written about enough forms. And I guess, like, okay, well, I'll go ahead and send this to the press. And it's been 2.5 years since the last one. I think there are good poets who write, who like just crank poems out that are, I think Franz Wright was definitely spotty, but I would never have wanted him to slow down, because I think he would have just died sooner if he had, like, he was, if he stopped writing, he would have died. Shane McRae feels a little bit the same way, like, writes insanely fast, but also, like, whatever is behind that, like, whatever the wind is behind that sail, I don't want to fuck with it. But I think a lot of people, do publish too many books, and very seldom do I think, if you're publishing more than once every 5 years, I think look at your last two or three books and say, which of these do I think are absolute killers? And if it's not every poem in the book, then you probably put, like, if it's not at least most of the poems in the book, like, have fewer books. I don't know. nobody is anxious for the next book. Somebody will just dispute me on that. But, like, I think very seldom do we say, like, oh, I can't wait for this book of poems to come out. Mm-hmm. It's a sentiment I've heard by almost nobody.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of true. I mean, books arrive in the mail for me, and I say, oh, it's nice they have a new book, and then you check it out. But it is rare, now that you mention it, that you're waiting on bated breath for a new one from somebody. I wondered if we'd get into this, because the poems you sent, the newer poems, have a lot to do with the publishing poetry industry and, about poetry readings and things like that. How much? Yeah. And I don't think we're gonna focus mostly on the book for the rest of the show. But since we're on this topic, how much of it, like what is the role of poetry in your life? You do this podcast, and you'd have the books, but you don't teach at a college. I'm right about that, right? Nope.
I don't teach at a college. I do teach mostly fiction at a little local, I shouldn't say low rent. It's like Grub Street in the Chapel Hill, Duke, mm-hmm. Raleigh Triangle, whatever, Durham Raleigh Triangle. I am maybe going to be teaching a class soon with Elijah Blumoff of Versecraft. So we're mm-hmm. figuring that out, but we may be teaching a poetry class that way. But I'm super ambivalent about mm-hmm. poetry classes. A real question that
It's rare for that. I'm just thinking about how, it's so rare that somebody's not in that world. You mentioned mm-hmm. that the sort of the publishing.
But neither you, right? You're not.
I'm not. Not at all. Yeah. And I wouldn't want to be. I don't think.
It's part of what keeps Rattle so like gratifyingly weird. I think it's just, it's like stuff you like, mm-hmm. right? That's what it should be. It's exactly. A college radio.
With no goal toward awards. So what is it? What I'm getting at, though, I mean, this book Midlife, which we haven't really gotten into yet, but Midlife is sort of about looking at your midlife, as the title would say, mm-hmm. and thinking about too. I mean, these are sort of mostly familiar poems and poems about relationships and things like that. But then the newer poems, interestingly, are about poetry's place sort of in midlife, and like there's sort of a what am I doing with my life type vibe to those poems. And so what are you doing doing with your life? Is, I guess, the question I want to ask. Like, do you think that dedicating your life to poetry as you have is something that you'd be thankful for? I was thinking about that reading the new poems because, you know, I was thinking, well, I feel sort of the same way. Like, I'm spending my life on this. Is it worth it? But then I think, what else would I spend it on that would be better? Right. And I come up with nothing. So, like, if I was, you know, like, say I was, you know, I just watched a football game yesterday. So I was like a producer for the football games on CBS or something. A friend of mine does that. Yeah. I would feel like that was sort of empty. And the poetry is so rich. And so there's this little loop that I go into a lot, too, about what we're doing here and why, given the small audiences, given the few people who, you know, really appreciate it, given the struggles that you have to do anything, to write a poem. I don't know how many poems it took to be your best poems, but they're a struggle every time. And then there's like so little reward too. So what is what do you think about your place, the place of poetry in your life, and why you did it, and are you grateful that you did?
I think, like you, my motto that gets me to sleep at night is, well, you have to bet your life on something, you know, like you gotta like, maybe it's not like I'm going to make it in the NFL, but it's going to be like I'm going to bother to spend all this time and energy and care somewhere on something, on someone. And, you know, there are certainly worse possibilities. Yeah, I don't know. I'm totally uncertain. I am very grateful for the people I have met through poetry, chief among them, you know, my wife, whom I met in the MFA program. But I don't know. I don't think I would, in a vacuum, recommend it to people who had other options. I don't know. I mean, even Cameron, who's very, very talented, he's also very young, you know, I think he's such a fiend for it. Like, it's so much part of who he is. I can't imagine him leaving it behind entirely, unless he went to be a gun runner like Rambo. But yeah, I don't think he's planning to go into academia. I mean, early in the podcast, I said, I think it's a little bit like a drug addiction. Like, I think the way we talk about, There's a weird sense that, like, it's okay that you're doing all this for poetry because poetry has some intrinsic, not even value, but like it's if we said the things we say about the time and the money and the effort and the care we spend on poetry, if we said them about heroin, we wouldn't have to change our statements very much, but people would look at us very differently. But at this point, I'm a heroin addict. I'm not going anywhere. Like, there's not another path for me.
Yeah. Well, let's see. I'm trying to, let me see. The poem, what did I think of? The public statement. Do you have that with you? Public statement from Blood Ray. That's one of the ones I was thinking about.
Yeah, Blood Ray.
There are a bunch of these that, you know, overheard at a reading is a good one too. This is the channel you're going down next. It's very clear from what you said.
There's some, yeah, I would say, like, between that and like staring into the abyss of depression, there's some, you know, it's a 601. Yeah. Do you want me to read public statement? Do you want what's
one
your
or the other? I think both are a good example of what we're talking about here.
Yeah. I'll read. Let me pull up. I feel like overheard at a reading is going to make more people angry, so I'll go for that one.
Okay, sounds good.
When I read this at Newburyport, which is, I think, the only place I've read it, I made a whole disclaimer at the beginning about how I was at a reading and I overheard someone saying this. There's a Carl Dennis poem where he says called A Colleague Confesses, and it's all in the voice of this other person. I will imagine that this is preceded by a disclaimer. I'll just say that. Overheard at a reading. My computer will open it up. Yeah. Enough high-handed free verse poems about some celebrated tyrant's tragic wife. enough feeling seen, enough banishing doubt, enough lending old grievances new life. Don't tell me writing is its own reward. Don't tell yourself there's wealth in all that knowledge. I'm too old for your prose poems and too bored to quake before the light you saw in college. Stop calling mediocre verse divine. Stop using parataxis as a crutch. Stop saving all your wit for the last line. Stop writing guzzles. Stop writing so much. Try teaching poems your students won't forget. Try reading schools you're not a member of. Quit politics. Pick up a cigarette. Delete your timeline. Fall in fucking love.
Yeah, that was overheard at a reading, a newer poem by Matthew Buckley Smith. And that's the sentiment that you have. That there's sort of a love-hate relationship going on, which I was very surprised to find.
You don't feel that? You don't feel a love-hate relationship with poetry?
Oh, definitely. I think everybody does, but nobody talks about it, which is why it's interesting.
Again, the podcast is Slee Ricketts.
So tell us about the podcast, too, because what is Slee Ricketts? Why is that the title?
So I was going to say, as I put on the t-shirt, I was like, oh, good. It's a good thing I chose a really obvious and memorable word in a really clear, legible font. This catastrophe. Yeah, I started this a few years ago at the tail end of the pandemic when I just was feeling very bad about poetry and then had a realization, which was that I had been keeping my mouth shut about my feelings on poetry for the sake of not burning bridges so that I would be able to have a career in poetry. I was like, well, shit, I'm not having a career in poetry. What am I doing this for? So I might as well enjoy myself on the way down. And that's where it started. Slee Ricketts, the name comes from, it's a corruption. My now 6-year-old daughter, when she was little, she couldn't say the word secrets. And so she, like a lot of, you know, in a kind of classic little kid confusion, she mixed up the word secrets with the action of whispering. And so when I would try to kind of soothe her to sleep while I was reading her story, if I started whispering, she would say, no Slee Ricketts, no Slee Ricketts. She wanted me to read loud. So that's where the word came from. So I figured I was telling some tales out of school. I should give it that name.
So what is it that
it is the only thing on the internet with that name. So it passes the Google test, which my name has never passed.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. That's a good idea. My name, of course, is ruined by the Disney movie. So there's that problem too.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah. Timothy Green, right. Yep. The magical child.
And the irony is that I switched to Timothy from just Tim because there was a football player who was famous and became a novelist. And so then all of a sudden I thought I was a novelist football player. And I'm like, no, I'm just a poet. And so I said, oh, I'll go by Timothy. That sounds poetic. And then Disney stole my name for a movie. So
you don't have it as bad as the designer who just got eliminated on Project Runway, who's first, he's a sweet guy. He's of Indian descent. His first name is COVID. Others have survived worse.
Well, the Google ability is very important. So what do you do on Slee Ricketts? So what is the podcast like and why should people listen?
So there are a lot of really good poetry podcasts. This being one of them, right? I mean, you have your own slightly different, I kind of appreciate when a podcast has its own weird wrinkle to it, which is true of like most of the podcasts, the poetry podcasts, at least I really like, Poetry Says, Versecraft, I Hate Matt Wall, Ratbag Poetics is a newer one. My wrinkle is that I guess it is a dumb show for smart people who like poetry. We don't always talk about poetry. We definitely get, we spent an episode recently talking about Harry Harlow, who's a scientist who famously performed horrible experiments on monkeys. But most of the people I talk with on the show are poets, Alice Allen, Cameron Clark, and then Brian Platzer is a novelist. We talk about other things. But I got into the habit of listening to a lot of dirtbag leftist politics podcasts and thinking that people get to have so much fun talking shit about politics and nobody does it with poetry. People are so polite about poetry. And I appreciate when there's a podcast that's like straightforwardly educational or like, let's read poems and like examine them technically. Like those are serving a clear function, but a lot of podcasts feel a little bit like it doesn't feel like the way poets talk when they're at the bar after the reading. It feels like the way poets talk at the podium during the reading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is the at the bar off mic conversation, but it happens on mic.
Mm-hmm. And so why do you think that is? I mean, is it to not burn bridges? It definitely is, like, very careful. We talked about a lot that it's hard to find people will even write interesting reviews of poems,
because
reads like a high school book report, where you're sort of praising something, maybe criticizing for three praises for every one criticism, and then five paragraph introduction conclusion. I mean, that's just how the reviews feel. It's so hard to find reviews that are interesting enough that anybody wants to read. But then the ones that don't sort of stand out so much as sort of smear pieces that they're like having too much fun with it, and there's sort of no in between. But why do you think we can't just have fun with it? Does it all go back to academia? Does it all go back to, like, everybody's trying to find a career and doesn't want to burn bridges, and so we're so careful about everything that we can't have fun anymore? Because I kind of feel that.
Yeah, I think that is some of it. I think that's certainly some of it. I do think that as the, MFA pyramid scheme is starting to collapse, I think that, like, as it becomes clearer and clearer that, like, no, you're not going to have a career in academia, maybe some of those pressures will relent. I also think there's something to we do tend to treat, like, there's a way people talk about poetry, even outside of the academy, where they talk about, like, the need for the importance of promoting poetry, the importance of getting people reading poetry, and the importance of getting poetry out there. And I kind of think, like, does anybody talk about the importance of getting movies out there, of getting, like, pop music out there? I don't know. I mean, I think that if you are treating it poetry has been divorced from, except in very, either Instapoets, who I'm not into, but I totally respect, or like Matt Wall, like weird sort of, weirdo punk rock poets. I think poetry has mostly been divorced from any kind of audience, immediate audience response,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, it's different. It's one of the reasons I'm fascinated by Rattle, like the podcast, the magazine, all of it, because you're just this guy who then publishes poems you like for an audience of readers who are linked up with you and your magazine and your podcast. But there's not some greater, structure that you're inside of. You're not, I mean, I don't know if you, maybe you do get grants from the NEA, in which case, great. I hope they do give you grants, but I think, like, a lot of poetry has been, lives in a kind of a stagnant fake economy where there's this weird, indirect relationship between people, like, applying for support or petitioning support from a committee or a panel or a body or a grant or foundation, and then getting resources, and then producing something that people maybe read, maybe pay for, but that doesn't really matter because that's not where the resources come from. Mm-hmm. I think I'm talking like I'm a capitalist. I'm not, if anything, I'm a dumb socialist, but I think, yeah, there's something too, just like the stagnant museum quality of the poetic, I don't know if it's a marketplace or an economy. That's why I'm a dumb socialist.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things I always think of is there's this concept in marketing where things could be sold as vitamins, medicine, or candy. Like candy is something that you want to eat, it's sort of sells itself, right? Because it's sweet. It's full of sugar.
Yeah.
And then, medicine, so it's going to relieve your suffering and your pain. But we tend to sell, that's what National Poetry Month does, and why I find National Poetry Month really annoying. It's like, eat your vitamins, kids, eat your broccoli.
Yeah.
Poetry is wonderful for you. And I think that has to do with all the grant writing that goes on. We have to sort of have this appearance that it's some kind of good for you vitamin that we're handing out. Right. And so people will give us grant money. And I think that's a big problem that to make poetry feel interesting too. I mean, the lack of sort of energy around reviews and discussion and just having fun with it, just is really pervasive. And I think that's a big problem.
Totally. Totally. And that's why it is, like, people were so blown away by Amanda Gorman's poem. I, like, talk to most poets, they're not crazy about it. I'm not crazy about it. But like people who weren't expecting anything but a normal, boring political event heard this poem, saw this, this charismatic figure, got this experience. They're like, oh, that was something. I'm so used to nothing. I'm so used to like Richard Blanco or God bless her, Maya Angelou droning on. Like this was something. And I think like that's it, again, it's the thing that happens in most poetry readings. People don't go expecting to enjoy themselves. They go expecting they treat it like church.
Yeah, it's interesting in a way
God
that
bless all the churchgoers out there, but like church is boring. Even
yeah.
Christian Wiman says it's boring.
Well, I don't know. I like the idea of poetry church actually. And as a with great sermons that, and songs you sing along to, and I don't know, there's a way that it can be like church in a good way, like the best kind of church.
Do you know the young Gene Lee play church?
No, I don't know.
It's really diabolical. And I think part of it is, I think it's very flawed, but at least like the first half and the bizarro ending is like brilliant. And it basically is like she created this experience for cynical, secular New Yorkers to go into this building and then like have this experience that was basically like this intense moral and musical and communal galvanization that like that I think is what church can be for people who really go into it and experience it intensely.
Yeah, I think so too. I don't know. The thing is, I think you and I both feel like we see a great poem, we love it. Like it turns on our whole little neurons are firing all over. It's like a little fireworks in your head. And
Sure.
how to get more people to appreciate that is just something that we always struggle with and find. And I wonder why it's so difficult, and why so many. Like you say, so many books of poems aren't interesting. I mean, there's just so many problems that sort of are heaped on just because of the way it's gone in this. I was talking to Dick Westheimer the other day about a friend of his who read poetry, was translated. He's a Mexican poet who has poems translated into Polish. And he went and they had a whole auditorium that was like the poetry stadium for having poetry performed. It wasn't like a music theater. It was like where you go to do poetry in Poland if you're, and so were there thousands of people there. And how do we do that? How do we make poetry interesting enough? Is it have to do, because one of the things that I always hear from regular people is like, it doesn't rhyme, there's no music. Like, and
Sure.
there's a music to free verse, which I love hearing. And you can
I
hear
like a lot of
rhythms
free
and those all
verse,
sorts
yeah.
of stuff, internal rhyme.
Of
But they
course.
do, there is a craving for more form and more true rhyme that you can hear
Yeah,
more
because it sounds
prominently.
good. Sounds good. That's why it's there. It sounds good.
Do you think that's one of the things that poetry is missing, is the more formalism?
I mean the problem is my dad is encouraging sometimes to be encouraging. My wife would say like there's no harder job than encouraging Matthew. My dad will say things like, oh, the world needs poets. I think my response is like, well, no, the world needs poems. And the problem is we've got a ton of those. Like we've got so many great poems from the last few thousand years. It's not like we have a pressing need for new ones. So yeah, I think people do really love and respond to, often it's like the elements in poetry that make it memorable. That is, in many cases, meter and rhyme. And so yeah, those sound really good and people like that. And there are plenty of people who want that and get it in pop music, in rap, in nursery rhymes, in existing poems. And I think they are hungry for that, enjoy that. I enjoy that. But I also think there's plenty of free verse that can be funny and memorable and biting and touching and surprising. I or like tell a good story even. I think there's plenty of good free verse that's like basically translatable. That's sort of what people say, oh, it's prose with line breaks. I don't really care. Is it good? Is it fun to listen to? Like, then translate it. Fine, whatever. Break it back into prose. It doesn't really matter to me as long as it has an effect. So I think the question is less like, how do we make poetry interesting than how do we make interesting poetry? Like, do the good work, and then, I think every poem ultimately survives. It's either there's like, well, there's dumb luck, and there's like the various unpredictable powers that be that select something and pass it on. But mostly it's, I really, this poem kills me, and somebody else I know has to read it. I'm going to show it to you. And then it either has an effect on you or it doesn't, and you pass it on or you don't. I think that's really what makes poems stick. And I try to do that on my podcast. I try to share poems I think are really killer. And I don't know beyond that. I don't, I mean, I'm so skeptical of like larger poetry programs or institutions. I mean, I think part of what I love about the Poetry Stadium you were describing is like, it's not just like, oh shit, they have this amazing audience. It's also like, well, when you go there, you better be interesting. Like when you're up on that stage, you can't be mediocre. There's none of this mumbly bookstore shit. Like you need to perform.
Well, that's what I always liked about the slam too. You know, with the audience, if you were terrible, you'd get booed off the stage. I mean, there's there's people start heckling you out of nowhere.
So crucial.
But
right.
And if you are good and if you are interesting, which is really what it's all about, the whole audience gets behind you when there's so much energy from that. Yeah. And I think that's exactly it. That's what we try to do with Rattle too. If you don't know, Alan Fox founded Rattle. He put up some of his own money and hired me to be the employee running it. For the last 20 years, I've been doing that. And all we do is pick poems we find interesting. Like we think people are really interesting. Yeah. They think they have interesting stories, you know, phrases and metaphors and ways of putting things that make you see the world a different way can be really interesting. And when we find interesting stuff, we share it. And that's pretty much all there is to it. And when there's a poet, you know, who writes, something interesting like you have and other people, we say, hey, go come on the podcast. Let me introduce them in this way. And we just go all around just trying to find things that are interesting and share them. That's all we really do. And with no other goals or affiliations. And that's the only reason I'm willing to do it as a career, you know? So anyway, that was such a big tangent. I didn't mean to go on that, but it's something we haven't really talked about on a show in a long time. It reminds me of the episode with Eric Campbell. If anybody likes this, go watch the one with Eric Campbell from like 34 or something. But anyway, I want to get back to your book though, because we do need poems. We do need to share what you're writing in this midlife book. So let's do another poem. Lullaby Before Birth is the next one up.
Yeah. This is one I wrote when my wife was pregnant with our first daughter. And I had a thought later on that it was only when A. Stallings has a wonderful poem called Ultrasound, which is about an ultrasound. But she had the funny experience of writing this thing that was just a description of an experience. And it's very evocative and memorable. I am the room the future owns, the darkness where it grows its bones. But then later, I think she had the experience of having people come to her and treat it as a political statement, as like a pro-life pennant. And I've had a little bit of that response to this poem, not to that extent because I'm not E. Stallings. But yeah, it is a funny case of like, I really wasn't trying to make a point. I just was trying to write about something that happened. Or something I thought and felt at the time. This is Lullaby Before Birth. For now, you can be happy, whatever you are called, a thing no hands have held, in darkness where you wait, and nothing soon will stop you unfastening the gate. Come through and you will find us, and cry until you can't. And every day you count a gift will be alone. And all the dark beyond us someday will be your own. So stay a little longer where morning isn't yet. And nothing is too late. And all the rest will keep. We grow, but never younger. And have no time to sleep.
Yeah, there's another great poem with a great last line, which is a thing that using rhyme and meter works. You can see how the rhyme makes a poem kind of click home at the end. And you have a bunch of last lines that are great like that. We grow but never younger and have no time to sleep. It's such a great closing for that poem. That was Lullaby Before Birth from Midlife, which is coming up, forthcoming soon from Matthew Buckley Smith. But
you click the reorder link and it looks fake because there's no image, but it is real.
Okay, wait, we'll click that link and go find the poem. Yeah. But so what is your writing process like? How do you come up with, how do you try to make a poem? You know, we talked about how poems should be interesting and that should be the main goal, however you're going to do it. how do you find ways to be interesting with words? Because it's, I mean, it's one of the hardest ways to be interesting is just having some squiggles of darkness on a white page. And then, and somehow it's moving and makes people cry and think and remember it until they die. How do you approach trying to do that?
Increasingly, I write quickly and cut. I spend less time revising and more time throwing away, if that makes sense. Like, yeah. Elijah wanted me to do a poem for his podcast. It was a group thing recently, and I wrote six poems because I needed to have five to throw away in order to have one that was okay. So I write a lot of poems. I try to sort of, I do these prompts with the ladies I write with are helpful because they're often something I would not think to write about. And they kind of force me to move in some directions I might not move rhetorically. I will also, a project or practice I've been taking up for a few years now is choosing a metrical form and a rhyme scheme and a length and writing 30 poems in that form as quickly as possible, and then leaving them for several months and then going back and throwing away all but a handful. And then those I'll work and work and work, but I guess it's sort of less I believe less in the discovery through sculpting and more in discovery through archaeology. Like I try to find after the fact if I said anything worthwhile. Or I mean the thing I thought reading Shakespeare's sonnets again a few years ago was that a lot of the sonnets were saying, making the same argument as one another, but they were making it a little worse or a little more awkwardly, or they kind of like only got started a few lines in and then it was, they tried to close too quickly. And so then it was only every so often that it just like the 14 lines landed with the 14 lines of thought and everything just hit just so. So I thought, well, maybe I will have some doing that. And so I try not to think too much about, I have very little insight into my own poetry. I have very little insight into my own poetry. I just try to pick out the things afterward that I think might have something to them.
Yeah. Well, let's hear another poem. Let's do poem without metaphors. Sure. We'll move through poems a little more quickly. Yeah.
Okay. Poem without metaphors. Which somebody asked me about and I thought like, well, I think technically it's still a metaphor, but whatever. Poem without metaphors. Some days there are no other words for pain. And for the worst, the literal is best. The rain against the glass is only rain. Your heart is just a muscle in your chest. The book ends in a bookish sort of way. The moonlight stands for nothing but the moon. Your children carry half your DNA and will inherit all your savings soon. Somewhere a car is racing through the night, no faster than a swiftly moving car. A brace of deer glance up at something bright, gone still, exactly like the deer they are. And as for you, you could be anyone. Who's done, who's said the things you've said and done.
And see what I was talking about those great last lines. Another great one with the rhyme pulling through, poem without metaphors. And that's just another great poem. And so you, the way that you write, you were saying, you're just iterating and pushing out a lot of stuff. Do they come out in the form like this? The iambic pentameter with a rhyme scheme, does the rhyme propel you forward in the poem? Or do you revise them into shape like this?
Oh no, I don't. I definitely don't have a thought ahead of time. I'll start with a line, but I definitely don't have a plan or an argument I know I'm going to make. Yeah, I think I mean, Stallings and plenty of other people have talked about this, but the form writes the poem as much as I do.
Mm-hmm. And so you hear, I guess you would hear the first line, some days there are no other words for pain. And that is what propels you forward. Like the rhythm of that, is that how you kind of approach a poem?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'll often like fish around until I find a first line that sounds plausible, but there's a thing called a divining rod, which I guess it's spelled like divining rod. Mm-hmm. You hold it like a Y-shaped stick. And it's sort of like that. There's a whole superstition about like who's, you know, it's sort of like a one man, like a Ouija board of one. And for me, that's writing poetry. Like I've spent a lot of time learning meter and drilling form. And, you know, if you want to write a good sonnet, I was talking to Cameron about this the other night, like the way to write a good sonnet is first write 100 sonnets and then write a sonnet. But yeah, I have very little insight into what the hell I'm doing.
Okay, well, let's do Last Call at the Conference Hotel.
Yeah, this is about a mythical phenomenon where people go to conferences and temporarily fall in love with people they're not married to. Last Call at the Conference Hotel. And there's a little bit of the Odyssey at the end, for those of you who know the Odyssey. Last Call at the Conference Hotel. At 2, they were still married, to others asleep back home. Talk having seldom varied from her favorite epic poem. They knew enough to keep shy of a nightcap in his suite, enough not to say goodbye or what year they might next meet. She pulled away from his side just one of her sun-bright hairs and laughed a last time, or tried, and carried herself upstairs. When she went, he turned to look at his hands and raised no wave and found the place in his book he'd half forgotten to save. But a man roped to a mast by his oarsman and his choice aches to return when he's past the final pitiless voice. And sirens forget the sweet nothing as soon as it's sung. And all one cannot repeat alters the heart with the tongue.
Yeah, so there's another poem from Midlife, Last Call at the Conference Hotel, from Matthew Buckley Smith. Do you go, speaking of being sort of disenthused with the literary world, do you go to conferences? What do you try to do to promote yourself and slew your rickets? Do you push stuff out and let it be? Or do you...
I don't know anymore. I don't know. I'll wear this t-shirt. That'll help. I have no idea. I'm not on social media. I was a little bit for a little while and it was horrible and I don't have any appetite for it. I go to the ALCW conference every year because my friend Ryan tells me to go, and I'm affiliated with their poetry magazine.
What's ALCW? I don't even know.
ALCW, the Association of Literary Scholars, Writers, and Critics. Mm-hmm. ALCW, no, Critics and Writers. I thought it was librarians, and I was humiliated.
Scholars. I thought the exact same thing. And
Stallings described it as the MLA for people who like to read books.
Well, that sounds better than the MLA. So
yeah. It's pretty interesting conference. So I go to that one. I have gone to Suwannee and Westchester in the past. I know Westchester sort of had what's the Dark Crystal where the ancient ones got split into the good and the evil half. I don't know. So there's Westchester and there's the Poetry by the Sea. Mm-hmm. But I don't know which one is the good and which one's the evil. But they
both
exist now. I
think it depends on who you ask.
Right. It's really true.
That's pretty much true.
Last time I went to that was 10 years ago. But that's more because I am old and boring and have kids than anything else.
So what do you find that what we kind of do at Rattle is we put out stuff we like and then people tell each other, and I don't even know how it works, but mm-hmm. we have an audience. Do you find that works? That if the love of the poetry and the discussion sort of carry itself along, or do you feel like you should be doing more to promote your own work?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel horrible every time I do something to promote because it's a gross feeling. But I'm sure I should. I mean, I think. Yeah, I'm terrible at this. I have no idea what I'm doing. I have no idea what works is the true answer. but yeah, it has been nice making a little bit of a community with some other Poetry Podcast, and then some other, you know, writers and people affiliated with magazines through the podcast more. I mean, that has connected me with people in the world more than certainly poetry ever has. Mm-hmm. I think just writing good work is not even remotely enough.
Yeah.
Even writing and publishing good work, I just think it's,
well, I mean, that's true, but I don't know what enough would be either. You know,
I
mean,
I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like I was talking to, Karan Kapoor and Shannon Mann, who have just wonderful Only Poems that they just started, but they kind of have
Only Poems. Is that a magazine?
Only Poems. Yeah. Yeah. It's like they have, I think, one poet a month, or maybe one a week. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonder they do a little interview with it. It's just great. And the fact that it's great, I think people appreciate and they're spreading it around. But I know Shannon just opened a Facebook account for the first time ever. So, and she was asking if that was worthwhile. And, you know, I mean, in a way it is, like, but it takes such a long time and it's sort of less worthwhile all the time. So the things that you can take advantage of to help poetry spread are diminishing too, because there's just this way, you know, everything is gamed and, you know, poetry doesn't win the algorithms very often.
No, unless it enrages people.
Well, there's that too,
which it doesn't do probably enough. I also had a Sleeve Rickets Twitter account for a little bit, and what I found was that it's not that you can have a Twitter account in order to support your podcast. It's that if you are good at Twitter and you like Twitter and you want to spend a lot of time doing that and you cultivate something there, then that as an existing part of your life can help out your podcast and vice versa. But I didn't want to do it for its own sake enough. I mean, I think like it's a form of writing I kind of respect. Like there is such a thing as like writing good tweets. Mm-hmm. It's its own thing. It's sort of like, you know, a lot of writers, you know, I knew in grad school would say things like I could write a romance novel, and like, that's true. You could, but you would have become a romance novel. It's like you could do it, but you can't do it without committing to making that then a whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it's definitely true. Well, I'm determined to get through all the poems because they're great. Let's do Requited Love next.
Yeah. Requited Love. I put in this one and then I put in the last one because my wife says, like, make sure people know you have a happy marriage. Requited Love. Here is the way they rose and bathed and fed in silence, and in silence got undressed, and microwaved the supper each thought best, and meant the words the TV actors said. Here is her naked hand outstretched in bed to soothe some restless memory's knocking chest, and here her present body, seldom pressed awake to his, and here his snoring head. Here are the things they thought they had to fear, the figure at the far end of a glance, neglected taxes, mice, the common cold, the lovely hair's retreat, the veins advance, the skulls a little clearer every year, shares held too long, the child they'd never hold.
And that was Requited Love. So, and this is from Midlife, the new book just about to come out by Matthew Buckley Smith. So when you saw, you know, the poems, I kind of asked this before, but I want to get a better sense of how you put the collection together. When you saw the poems and you were pulling out the best poems of the last 9 or 12 years, however you want to count it, how did you know that they fit in the book? Or did you just, was it just like a sense of poems, which is something we don't do very often, but that you wanted poems because they're good, but then how do you order them and how do you make something that feels cohesive? How did you put that together?
Yeah, how I put it together is I took a swing at it and showed it to Ryan, and he said, it's missing something. It feels a little relentless. It's kind of depressing. And so I waited another few years and wrote some more poems and took some poems out and then showed it to him again. And he said, yeah, this is the wrong order, though. So he gave me an order and I worked on it and I showed it to, you know, Jonathan Farmer and Alan Shapiro, a couple other people I trust. And basically my goal is not to make a cohesive whole or to make an arc or a narrative. My goal is to put the poems in an order such that you can read them in that order and it won't fuck you up. Like, it won't, you won't think like, oh, that's a weird, like, why, you know, my wife is terrible at making mixtapes. Like, she'll always follow a really sweet, like, heartbreaking love ballad with like a real jangly jig. And you're like, oh, that, don't do that. So I'm just trying not to, fuck up the vibe.
So keep a vibe going is the advice. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way. And, you know, just the order of it. And I think you don't want to have a one monotone kind of feel, you know, or like a swooping arc that's all the same, but sort of to have surprise, to some delight within disorder, that kind of thing makes for a good, good collection.
Yeah. You don't, you're going to need the tie should be a little crooked if your suit's really straight.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So let's, we're up on time. Let's wrap it up with the new poem. I love the new one, Where the Wild Things Are. That you want to
sure thing.
The,
This is the one. This is the one. My wife was like, "Oh, I like that one." Instead of all your miserable wife poems, she's quite lovely and thankfully has a good sense of humor. This is Where the Wild Things Are. On the off chance that my daughters are still awake and watching this, babies come from the stork. I love you very much. This is Where the Wild Things Are. In the book, our daughters love dark thickets spring up from the floor to claim young Max's room, supplanting every pale familiar thing with starlit branch and stamen, stalk and bloom. So when you set the White Noise app to play its loop of forest sounds on a summer night and shut the blinds and strip and shyly say, you wouldn't mind if I turned out the light, I wonder if our girls upstairs might hear the savage noises coming from beneath and think again of Max's friends and fear once more the terrible eyes and claws and teeth, and whether they'd be any less afraid to learn these were the woods where they were made.
Yeah, it's a great poem, Where the Wild Things Are. You see, it's first published in Able Muse, which is a great press for formal poetry. If you'd like the style of poetry Matthew's reading, Able Muse is a great place. I'm not sure if their message board is still active as much as it used to be.
It is. Yeah, Erratosphere is still up. Alex is a great great patron of formal poetry. And I should say, this is supposed to come out in April. I don't know if it's come out yet, but... Thank you, Alex. He's very understanding.
Yeah, that's Alex Pepple. And it's really, I should have him. He doesn't send poems in, though. I wish, tell him if you see him, tell him to send me some poems so we can have him on a Rattlecast.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, he's wonderful and does Able Muse. And they publish so many of the formalist poets that are really good. And that message board, if anybody's interested in learning more, they, at least when I used to go there, they would critique, you know, people would just critique and talk about the meter and which feet are off and all that kind of stuff. And really hone people and get better and better at writing through the internet, which is a great thing too. And Alex just does a great job with Able Muse. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for sharing your poems and for the candid discussion. It's been a lot of fun, Matthew.
Yeah.
Well, and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you. I'm just really impressed by this whole thing you got going. And I've always been a fan of Rattle and of your. You as a man apart.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. So where can people find Slea Ricketts? Just type in Slea Ricketts.
SleaRicketts.com will work. That'll take you to my website. But yeah, you can also just look. Yeah, Matthew Buckley Smith. My website has all the links for everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, well, sounds good.
Yeah, come check it out.
Yeah, thanks for sharing and for the discussion. It was a lot of fun.
Right. Yep. Have a good night. Happy New Year.
You too. You've been listening to our conversation with Matthew Buckley Smith. You can find more of his work, including his new book, Midlife, at MatthewBuckleySmith.com, and find his podcast at SleaRicketts.com. Find the full interview plus our prompt lines and Poet Respond to open the show on YouTube.com/RattlePoetry. Next week's guest in the Rattlecast is going to be Miracle Thornton. Miracle was one of the three winners of the 2023 Rattle Chapbook Prize. Her chapbook, Plucked, just came out, along with a winner issue for all Rattle subscribers. It's an imaginative portrait of black girlhood, one of the most abstract books I think we've published in the series. Really looking forward to talking to her as a guest. That'll be Rattlecast number 227, Monday, January 8th at 8 p.m. Eastern. Hope you have a great weekend in the meantime, and I'll talk to you later. Goodbye.